Welcome to a continuing series of messages surveying books of the Bible. Our speaker is Dr. Ken Boa, president of Reflections Ministries and Trinity House Publishers. Today's study is a look at the poetic books. Here now is Dr. Ken Boa.
Welcome to the Talk Through the Bible Visual Bible Overview Series. Today we're going to survey the five poetical books of the Old Testament to give you a better feel for the content of these books as you begin to study them. Until recently, not many people knew that fully one-third of the Hebrew Bible was written in poetry. This became more obvious when poetic sections were set off from prose sections in some English translations. In fact, there are only five Old Testament books that appear to have no poetry: Leviticus, Ruth, Ezra, Haggai, and Malachi. The five books now known as the poetical books serve as a hinge which links the past of the historical books to the future of the prophetical books. These books explore the experiential present and emphasize a lifestyle of godliness. Unlike the Pentateuch and 12 historical books, the poetical books do not advance the story of the nation Israel. Instead, they delve deeply into crucial questions about pain, God, wisdom, life, and love, all in the present tense. The Book of Job. Job was a righteous man who was suddenly embroiled in an intense ordeal of every kind of suffering. He went through three cycles of debate with his friends, who insisted that his misfortune must have been caused by sin. When God finally revealed himself in his majesty and power to Job, it became obvious that the real issue was not Job's suffering, but God's sovereignty. Job's questions were never answered, but he willingly submitted to the wisdom and righteousness of God. The Book of Psalms. The five books of Psalms span the centuries from Moses to the post-exilic period and cover the full range of human emotions and experiences. The wide variety of psalms, lament, thanksgiving, praise, enthronement, pilgrimage, etc., suited them for service as the temple hymnal for the people of Israel. The psalms were set to music and focused on worship. The Book of Proverbs. Proverbs was designed to equip the reader in practical wisdom, discernment, discipline, and discretion. These maxims emphasize the development of skill in all the details of life so that beauty and righteousness will replace foolishness and evil as one walks in dependence upon God. The Book of Ecclesiastes. The preacher of Ecclesiastes applied his great mind and considerable resources to the quest for purpose and satisfaction in life under the sun. He found that wisdom, wealth, works, pleasure, and power all led to futility in striving after wind. The problem was compounded by the injustices and uncertainties of life and the apparent absurdity of death. The only source of ultimate meaning and fulfillment is God Himself. One should therefore acknowledge his inability to understand all the ways of God, trust and obey Him, and enjoy His gifts. Song of Solomon. This beautiful song portrays the intimate love relationship between Solomon and his Shulamite bride. It magnifies the virtues of physical and emotional love in marriage. Now let's look at some distinctive elements of Hebrew poetry. The story of the divided kingdom continues in 2 Kings as it carries Israel and Judah to their bitter ends. None of the 19 kings of Israel did what was right in the sight of God, and their corruption led to captivity at the hands of the Assyrians in 722 BC. Judah lasted longer because 8 of its 20 rulers followed the Lord. But Judah also fell in judgment and was carried away by the Babylonians between 605 BC and 586 BC. The five poetical books illustrate three kinds of poetry. First, Lyric poetry, originally accompanied by music on lyre, this poetry often has strong emotional elements, most of Psalms. Second, didactic poetry, teaches principles about life by means of maxims, Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. And third, dramatic poetry, dialogue in poetic form, Job and Song of Solomon. Hebrew poetry is not based on assonance, which is rhyme, or meter. It has some rhythm, which is produced by tonal stress, but this is not prominent. The real key to this kind of poetry is parallelism, which involves the rhyming of ideas through careful arrangement of parallel thoughts. At least six kinds of parallelism have been distinguished in Hebrew poetry. First, synonymous parallelism. Here the second line reinforces the thought of the first by using similar words and concepts. Examples are Job 38:7, Psalm 3:1, 25:4, 49:1, Proverbs 11:7 and 25, and 12:28. Second, synthetic parallelism. The second line adds to or completes the idea of the first line. Examples include Psalm 1, 1-2, 23, 1 and 5, 95, 3, and Proverbs 4, 23. Third, antithetic parallelism. The thought of the first line is contrasted in the second line. Examples include Psalm 1, 6, 18:27, and Proverbs 10, 1, 14, 34, and 15, 1. Fourth, emblematic parallelism. The first line uses a figure of speech to illuminate the main point conveyed by the second line. Examples include Psalm 42:1, Proverbs 11:22, 25:25, and 27:17. Fifth, climactic parallelism. The second line repeats the first with the exception of the last term. Examples include Psalm 29:1 and Proverbs 31:4. Sixth, formal parallelism. The lines are joined solely by metric considerations. An example is Psalm 2:6. Parallelism is found not only in couplets, which have two lines, but also in triplets and quatrains, which are three and four lines, and sometimes in whole stanzas. Hebrew poetry is also characterized by vivid figures of speech. First, simile, a comparison between two things that resemble one another in some way. Examples include Psalm 1, 3-4, 5:12, 17:8, and 131:2. Second, metaphor, a comparison in which one thing is declared to be another. Examples include Psalm 23:1, 84:11, and 91:4. Third, implication, an implied comparison between two things in which the name of one thing is used in place of the other. Examples include Psalm 22:16 and Jeremiah 4:7. Fourth, hyperbole, the use of exaggeration to emphasize a point. Examples include Psalm 6:6, 78:27, and 107:26. Fifth, rhetorical question, the use of a question to confirm or deny a fact. Examples are Psalm 35:10, 56:8, 94:6, and 106:2. Sixth, metonymy, one noun used in place of another because of some relationship between the two. Examples include Psalm 5:9, 18:2, 57:9, and 73:9. Seventh, anthropomorphism, assigning an appropriate part of the human body to God's person to convey some truth about God. For example, Psalm 11:4, 18:15, 31:2, and 32:8. Eighth, zoomorphism, assigning an appropriate part of an animal to God's person to convey some truth about God. Examples, Psalm 17:8, 36:7, 63:7, and 91:4. Ninth, Personification, assigning the characteristics of a human to lifeless objects. Examples are found in Psalm 35:10, 77:16, 96:11, and 104:19. Tenth, apostrophe, addressing lifeless objects. Example, Psalm 114:5. 11th, synecdoche, representation of the whole by a part or a part by the whole. For example, Psalm 91:5. Visual imagery is clearly predominant in the poets. Another technique in Hebrew poetry is the alphabetic acrostic. The first Hebrew letter in a line is the first letter of the alphabet, the second is the second letter of the alphabet, and so on, as shown here in Psalm 25. There are several variations on this technique, for example, Psalm 119, and each chapter in Lamentations. There are also three books of wisdom within the poets: Job, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes. These books are denoted as such by the content, not the form. It is likely that there were schools of wisdom in Israel. See 1 Samuel 24:13 and 1 Kings 4:29-34. These wise men were practical observers of life who gave right answers in critical situations. There is an interesting progression with the poetical books, beginning with Job. Seeing God's sovereignty causes us to worship. Worship, as displayed in Psalms, develops the fear of the Lord. The fear of the Lord, the theme of Proverbs, is the beginning of wisdom. And wisdom, as discussed in Ecclesiastes, will help us overcome life's vanities. Or it can help maintain a godly marriage like Solomon's and the Shulamites, as shown in the Song of Solomon. Finally, let's look at some applications from the poetical books. Our first application concerns the fact that God is always watching. Proverbs 15:3 says, "The eyes of the Lord are in every place, watching the evil and the good." This verse provides a great example of the use of anthropomorphism, wherein the writer assigns an appropriate part of the human body to God's person to convey some truth about God. In this case, Solomon assigns human eyes to God's person to convey the truth that he is a God who is always vigilant, who is always aware of human behavior everywhere, always. Further, God is particularly tuned into the good and the evil of our behavior. Thus, the quality of our behavior matters to him, and by extension, it should also matter to us. On the one hand, the truth of God's constant vigilance is comforting because when believers approach the judgment seat of Christ, we can be assured that our works will be judged with absolute accuracy because God will have overlooked no detail in seeing and understanding the sinful, hurtful, or compromising behavior of others towards us that may have contributed to sin we may have committed in response to them. God sees all and has a completely clear picture of every moment of every event in our lives. We will be judged fairly, and those who have sinned against us will also be judged fairly. In fact, judged perfectly without any error and without missing a single fact. On the other hand, this truth is also sobering because God sees all and will call us into account on the day when, according to my gospel, God will judge the secrets of men, Romans 12:16. If we reflect upon our private thoughts and actions over the past month or so, and consider what it would be like to have every one of our thoughts and deeds filmed and then played back to our friends and family, at certain moments we would likely feel embarrassed and uncomfortable. And yet we still choose to sin, knowing we are doing so when He is watching. We may rationalize our behavior, thinking and doing things in or out of the presence of others that we would not do in God's presence, simply because we presume upon God's acceptance, believing that He accepts us in the way we are, rather than on the basis of what He hopes we will someday become. We may think, well, he loves and accepts me unconditionally, so it does not matter that I sin just this one time. He will still love me. Or we may rationalize our sin on the basis that we hope that God will be less judgmental than our friends. Since he knows more, he'll be more understanding, we may reason to ourselves. But this kind of thinking is dangerous. God may be more understanding than our friends by virtue of his love and compassion, but he is also far more discerning than them as well, knowing the thoughts and intentions of our hearts. He is capable of assessing not only innocence, but also guilt. We do well to meditate on David's 51st Psalm. Against thee, thee only, I have sinned and done what is evil in thy sight, so that thou art justified when thou dost speak, and blameless when thou dost judge. Psalm 51:4. When we sin privately, we may not hurt anyone else, but we still are sinning against God. As such, there is always a vertical dimension to our behavior, not only horizontal. It is important to remember that the one whose judgment most counts is also the one who sees all. Whatever level of accountability we face with our family and friends is far less than the accountability that we face with the one who will judge the living and the dead. And while he unconditionally accepts every believer, he will also hold each man responsible for his choices and behavior by judging them. At the end of the day, when we review some of our most significant words, thoughts, and actions, if we find that we want to hide any of these from our friends and family, we may also find that we want to hide these things from God. But let us bring these things out into the light of truth and forgiveness, but with genuine repentance, knowing that he has already seen and known what we've done. But in the future, when our conscience pricks us about a thought, word, or deed that we would be ashamed for others to know or see, let us remember that the eyes of the Lord are watching too. May we not do in front of him what we would not do in front of our friends or family. One of the signs of having been born again by the Spirit of God is a new awareness that our Lord of love is watching, and that, as the last verse of Ecclesiastes teaches, God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. Ecclesiastes 12:14. The second application concerns romantic love. The Song of Solomon is, as its first verse declares, the Song of Songs. It is a song of romantic love that is above all other songs. It demonstrates God's approval and intention for marital love that is passionate and intense and physical. This beautiful piece of divine poetry shows a love relationship that abounds as the lovers engage in verbal affirmations, playfulness, pursuit of each other, as well as working through difficulties. As writer André Soux puts it, "We thought we had made too much of love when we had made too little of it." For some of us, the song is not only helpful but essential. It gives permission to be as in love as you want to be. It destroys the notion that God grants romance as a concession but holds his nose. It debunks the notion of lovesickness as a brief biological agitation for the prosaic purpose of perpetuation of species. If your marriage passes from intoxication into humdrum cohabitation, it is not God's idea. Instead, we find a kind of passionate love shared between spouses in the song likened to the very flame of the Lord. "Put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death. Jealousy is as severe as Sheol. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it. If a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised." Song of Solomon 8:6-7. Should we find our marriage in an inevitable trough phase, we may be instructed by studying the Song of Songs to see what the king and the Shulamite noticed about each other, how they interacted with each other, and how they freely expressed their love to each other, and then do something similar or something else meaningful with our own spouse. May we consider what little foxes that spoil the vineyards have run into our garden and our vineyard and hindered intimacy with our spouse. Perhaps unresolved hurt, unforgiveness, bitterness, slothfulness, inconsiderateness, double-mindedness, or self-centeredness can spoil much of the fruit of our marriage, which God intended for us to richly enjoy. Let us give thought to these things, and then have the faith to take action by pursuing and caring for the heart of our spouse, just as our loving Lord pursues and cares for our heart. The third application concerns swearing to our own hurt. Psalm 15, one of David's shortest psalms, describes in 5 verses the character qualities of someone who is a citizen of Zion, someone worthy of dwelling in the presence of the living God. David writes, O Lord, who may abide in thy tent? Who may dwell on thy holy hill? He who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart. He swears to his own hurt and does not change. Psalm 15, 1, 2, and 4. The key parts of this citizen's character are his integrity, his commitment to doing what is right, and his commitment to speak truth. A manifestation of these qualities is swearing to one's own hurt, meaning keeping one's word, even when it is painful. Much of what we commit to doing for others is relatively easy to fulfill, but some things we commit to doing can be costly in terms of what we must sacrifice in order to keep our word. For example, we may commit to joining a friend in an activity on a certain day when our boss calls and needs us to work instead. Or we may agree to sell an item to someone, only to find out in the middle of the transaction that the item's value is significantly more than we had priced it. But in order to keep our word, we take what we originally asked for it. As such, we may choose to forego an opportunity for gain for the sake of our integrity. Alternatively, we may expend more time, energy, and money than would otherwise be prudent in order to keep our word, such as agreeing to volunteer for a particular event, only to find when the time to volunteer came that our schedule was packed so tightly with so many unforeseen challenges and difficulties that our energy level and desire are completely exhausted. But we do our duty by volunteering in spite of the difficulty, because we want to be faithful to our word and maintain our integrity. We swear to our own hurt. In so doing, we glorify the Lord by demonstrating his faithfulness to his word to others. We live out godliness. And it seems that God inevitably tests our willingness to do what we say as part of building our character. In these integrity tests, we are faced with the question of whether we believe that God is big enough to make up whatever loss we might incur as a result of keeping our word. Are we willing to swear to our own hurt where our yes is yes or our no is no? Will we choose to live out eternal values in the temporal in spite of the cost? Certainly, we should judiciously and carefully choose what we commit our time and energy toward so that we can be reasonably sure that we can do what we say we will do. But when the doing part becomes difficult, swearing to our own hurt by staying true to our words in spite of the cost will serve to tangibly mirror to others God's own constant faithfulness to us.
Thank you for listening to this talk, which is part of a series of messages by Dr. Ken Boa. To order additional talks on CD or MP3, or to learn about any of Dr. Boa's other Bible-based teachings, go to our web ministry at kenboa.org. That's kenboa.org. Or call 1-800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 1-800-372-9632.